This is Fresh Air. I'm Cherry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with B.B. King, the great blues guitarist and singer. He has a new autobiography called Blues All Around Me, in which he describes his journey from Mississippi sharecropper to the world's best-known blues musician. You grew up on a plantation, then left it to go to Memphis, which is where you started really playing music professionally. It's a great story how you left the plantation. You were driving a tractor. This was a problematic tractor that had problems with after ignition. So one day you turned off the tractor, walked out of the tractor, and then the tractor started jumping on its own, rammed into the barn. The exhaust pipe got crushed or, broke off.
Yes.
And you were afraid of how much money you'd owe the plantation owner.
No, I was afraid that I would be killed.
Oh, even worse.
No. Well, he'd never kill anybody, but he, I don't mean it that way, but scared to death. You know, like if you, your mom cooked a cake and you decided that, you're going to get a piece of it and you drop it, and it spills on the floor. Brand new cake that's made for the family, you would feel that mom is going to surely kill you, so you better get out of there. Well, that's the way I felt that the time that the tractor, when it backfired, and ran out into there, scared me half to death. So I panicked and left, hitchhiked to Memphis. Going from Indianola to Memphis then was like, to me, like leaving Chicago, going to Philly. It was that far. That's the way it seemed at the time. So I was scared to death. I left and stayed for a while and communicated back with my family and my cousin Booker White. Said, go on back there and take your medicine. So I finally went back, and Mr. Barrett was a very nice guy, a man that I admired so much. I wished I could be a lot more like him.
The good thing is, too, is that that accident forced you to leave the plantation. Maybe you wouldn't have left if it wasn't
that. No. I had planned to leave.
You did?
Yes, I had planned to leave. I had worked with a group called St. John Gospel Singers, and I thought we were very good. And believe it or not, I thought we was getting close to being like the Soul Stirrers, with
the Sam Cooke's group.
Sam Cooke, you got it. The Golden Gate Quartet, that was the Pilgrim Travelers and many other quartets that we admired and wanted to be like them. And I thought we was, kind of a good opening act for some of them. And I'd wanted to leave 2 or 3 years before that. However, I had asked the guys a couple of years before to leave, let's go. I believe we're ready. And each time the crops would be bad or something like that, and somebody would have an excuse, say, well, we didn't do so well this year, let's try it again next year. And I was about fed up with hearing that. I was about ready to go anyway.
What was Memphis like when you got there? What impressed you the most?
It was like, let's say you lived in Cairo, Illinois, and you moved to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's what Memphis was like. Wow. Great big city. I'd never been in a city that large before.
And did you feel like, hey, this city is mine, or did you feel like, I don't belong here?
No, I felt that it was a place of learning because I was lucky. My cousin Booker White lived there, and I had a chance to meet a lot of people when I came to Memphis. And I would go down on Beale Street and hear all these fine musicians playing, especially on the weekends. Memphis was sort of like, again, Chicago or any of the major metropolitan areas, people was coming through, going east or west. In other words, it was sort of like a meeting place, if you will, a port for people traveling from different places. So I had a chance to meet a lot of great giants in the business, jazz and otherwise. So I felt it was something, or a place rather, that I could learn.
Bluesman Sonny Boy Williamson had a radio show when you got to Memphis, King Biscuit Time. And you went up to him and asked to sing on the program. It seems to me like you must have had the courage to just come in like that.
Well, before I left Indianola, my hometown, Indianola, Mississippi, I used to hear Sonny Boy over in Helena, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
He would come on air each day at 12:15 and for about 15 minutes for the King Biscuit Company. And I felt that I knew him. It's sort of like watching TV or listening to you. Person listen to you and feel that they can trust you and feel that they really know you. You become like a name in the family. So that's the way I felt when I met him. I didn't know him, but it seemed to me I had known him all this time. So when I got to Memphis, he was in West Memphis, which is across the Mississippi River in Arkansas. I went over and I felt, I guess I would have been hurt very badly had he not talked with me.
He let you sing on his show.
Yes, he did. I guess he said a guy got this much nerve, and I'm very homely looking.
What'd you sing?
I sang one of Ira Joe Hunter's song. Ira Joe Hunter, if you're not familiar with him, was a great songwriter and great musician. He made a lot of tunes, one or two that you probably have heard. Anyway, I sang one of his tunes called Blues at Sunrise.
And you got a response?
Very much so. Sonny Boy seemed to like it. And Sonny Boy was a very big guy, you know. His eyes was not very clear, looked a little red-like, and he was a very big fella. And at that time, I weighed about 127, and he stood about, 6 feet or more, and looking down on me, you know, like, hey, you better sing right. And I said, yes, sir.
Well, you ended up getting your own radio show as well as your own gigs in Memphis. When you were on the radio, one of the things that we had to do was sing, well, write and then sing a jingle for Pepticon, which was what, a kind of cure-all remedy?
Yes. Pepticon was a tonic that was supposed to be good for whatever ails you. And we sold a lot of it. And I think a lot of it had to do, I didn't learn until much later that it was 12% alcohol, so a lot of the older people bought it, especially church people. They bought a lot of it.
The only way to drink and be legit.
Well, I won't say that, but I do know that they bought it, and older people mostly bought it, and someone sent me a bottle about 6 or 7 years ago. I have it at home now, and it was, I think, 12% alcohol.
Would you sing the jingle you wrote?
Well, do you really want me to do this?
Mm-hmm.
You really do. Okay. Pepticon show is good. Pepticon show is good. Pepticon show is good. You can get it anywhere in your neighborhood.
And do that sell a lot of Pepticon?
We sell a lot of it. I used to ride the trucks on the weekend with the salesman, and people would stand in line, sort of like going to a concert or a movie. We sold a lot of it.
Now, you had a stutter, but here you were on the radio, playing records, selling the tonic that you were selling. Did you stutter on the air?
Not so much. I had a lot of help there at the radio station. Rufus Thomas, my boss, Mr. Ferguson, Bert Ferguson.
Was this WDIA?
WDIA.
Right, this was like the first all-black music format in the country,
yes,
I think. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. First one. And I had people like Professor A.C. Williams, Professor Nat Williams that was there.
Mm-hmm.
That was Mr. Kearns, Darren Kearns. There was so many people that were there that helped me out so much.
Now, I want to get to another record recorded in 1952. You were 26. This is a recording of 3 O'Clock Blues. It had been a hit a
yes.
few years before for Lowell Fulsom.
Right.
This was your first number one record on the R&B charts.
Very first.
You're coming into your own here, don't you think, as a stylist?
I'm a very happy guy to know that somebody tells me that I have a hit record. I was very happy to hear that. I think that's music to each performer's ear, to hear that they have a top-selling record or CD.
Let's hear it.
In the morning, can't even close my eyes. Oh, 3 o'clock in the morning, baby, can't even close my eyes. satisfied.
That's B.B. King, recorded in 1952. How did that record, your first record, went to number one on the R&B charts, change your life?
Well, it changed my life in many ways. One thing, financially, because I had been making about $60 a week at this radio station. And I would go out and pick cotton. I would drive trucks and tractors. I did everything to try to make ends meet, if you will, because my music wasn't taking care of me. And when I made 3 o'clock Blues, I started then to get guarantees, maybe like $400 or $500 a day when I played out. And that made a big difference, as far as financially speaking, because then I could hire more people to work with me. It made life easier. I could get a driver to keep from having to drive all the different places by myself. And my wife and I was able to live better, able to pay the band better. I was able to do many things that I hadn't been able to do prior to that. And, of course, popularity was much more popular, if you will. And I just started to feel then that I was a real entertainer.
My guest is B.B. King. He has a new autobiography called Blues All Around Me. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with B.B. King. In the 1950s, you toured on a black music circuit, and you weren't crossing over, even into the early 60s, to white audiences the way other African-American performers who were playing more rock and roll had started to do. Chuck Berry, Little Richard. Did you want to cross over? Were you frustrated that you weren't crossing over?
Well, in the beginning, I was really confused about the way the politics ran in music. I always thought if you made a good record, it was a good record. If it was a hit record, it was a hit record. And people, not black, not white, red or yellow, but people would like it. Some people would like it. But I learned quickly after I got into the music business that there are so many categories, and you can get lost. You're like a little fish in a big pond, and more so if you're a blues singer, blues musician.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not really wanting to be a crossover, actually, but I wanted all people to hear it and like it. I was hoping, rather, they would like it. And people like Ray Charles, people like Chuck Berry, all these guys to me were very talented, and they was very energetic. Lloyd Price and so on, all of them was very energetic when it come to playing music. They didn't play the slow droopy drawers music like I did, so I found that maybe that was my reason, because they had things that I didn't have, other way musically or entertaining.
Well, they were playing to teenage audiences, and as you've always pointed out, your audience
was always my age and older.
Yeah, so... Mm-hmm. Could you imagine yourself crossing over to teenagers, playing to teenagers?
No, I could not. And again, I'm trying to say that to hear the people that I mentioned playing,
mm-hmm.
I was never envious of them, because me, I'm the country boy that, you know, that left the country, but they never got the country out of me. So I didn't have that, stage presence that they have. So I was never envious of them being able to get over, but I would hope that people sometime would pay more attention to what I was doing.
In the mid-60s, I guess it was, a lot of the rock guitarists started emulating you. I mean, you became a god to some of them. Mike Bloomfield, Eric Clapton. And that helped introduce your music to college audiences, and then you started playing the college circuit in addition to the places you'd already been playing. What was it like for you to start playing the college circuit? Did you feel like did it feel very different to you? Did you feel like you needed to change anything about your performance style? Was there anything you were doing that didn't seem to translate?
Yes, I was frightened at first. Here I am, a high school dropout, and I'm going to be playing to college audiences. Yes, I felt that I should wear a hard hat and be Fred Astaire or Nat Cole.
Be real suave.
Yeah. But I remember after 3 o'clock blues, I had a manager, and he told me when I was going, it used to be a saying that for a black performer, it was four theaters you had to play and be accepted before you would be accepted as a true entertainer. One of those theaters was the Howard Theater in Washington, the Royal Theater in Baltimore, and the master itself was the Apollo Theater in New York, in Harlem. So my manager told me then, I lived in Memphis, he said, don't go to New York and these other places. Oh, and by the way, the fourth theater was the Regal Theater here in Chicago. However, my manager said, do not go to New York trying to be Nat Cole or anybody else that's trying to be slick, because there are people that sweep in the floors that are much better than you'll ever be. So the best thing for you to do is go there and be B.B. King.
What good advice.
Sing 3 o'clock blues. Mm-hmm. Sing the song that you sing the way you sing them. He said, now, all these other people can do all of those other things, but they can't be you as you can be you. And that I've tried to keep from then until now.
It's been said that you've always felt bad that you dropped out of school, never went to college. Were you self-conscious about that when you were actually playing colleges?
Yes, very much so. I thought that my shortcoming as far as education was concerned would make me not be, shall we say, good enough to play for a lot of those people.
But it was probably just the opposite, that your audience really wanted to be you.
Well, I don't know about that, but they did show me that they appreciated me being there. They mm-hmm. still do that. They showed me that they was really with me and supported me in what I was doing. So they gave me confidence.
I have met over the years a lot of people who've worked with you or toured with you. And it's just not possible, I think, to get anybody to say a bad word about you. I mean, your reputation is of somebody who treats everybody around him really well, with a lot of respect, always fair. Financially and in all other ways as well. And I'm just wondering if that's something that you consciously set out to do. I'm not just trying to be nice here. I mean, I think it's just a kind of a fact that you're known for this. I wonder if you think of yourself just naturally Mr. Nice Guy, or if it's something that you've felt really obliged to do and have been very conscious about doing.
There are some things that I've read that I truly believe in. I believe that one should treat others as they want to be treated. And that's one of the things that I try to live by, if you will, is trying to be fair to people as I want them to be to me.
B.B. King, his new autobiography is called Blues All Around Me. This is Fresh Air. My guest is B.B. King. He has a new autobiography called Blues All Around Me. I got a question about your autobiography.
Uh-oh.
The autobiography, which is co-written with David Ritz.
Right.
It goes into some of your kind of sexual life. And
I love women. Still do.
That's fine.
At 71, I still love them.
Here's my question, though. Did you have any intention of getting that explicit about your life as it ended up getting? Did he have to really push you to do that, or were you comfortable with
that? No, he didn't have to push me. When we agreed to do the book, I had said to David and some of my close associates that I would be as candid as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So someday after I'm dead, people are going to say, yes, B.B. King has 15 kids by 15 different women. So I might as well to get the heat now. It's all right. At least it's now in the open. But I must say, and I'll say to you, if had a chance to explain, I think a lot of people would understand it much better than I can say to you at this moment. But this was not love children. This was not something that just happened overnight. By the way, I've lived now 71 years, so this took a time to happen. And if I had my life to live over again, I would, at this time, knowing what I know now, would have done a lot of the things differently. But the ways of prevention at that time was not as easy as it is today. A lot of the people during my time coming up have big families. And the only way to prevent having a lot of children a lot of times had to do with doing things that a lot of men, especially this man, don't enjoy doing to prevent it. So there I am.
Okay.
I hope I've made a little sense.
So you're comfortable with the sexual material in the book?
I love my children. I don't say this to brag that I have 15 kids by 15 different women, but since it has happened, mm-hmm. I'm crazy about them. They all are doing well. Only two or three has been in trouble, and we've been in touch constantly since their early life till present time. I have grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I'm proud of all of them. Some of them went to school like I wanted them to do. I wasn't a very good father because I was away most of the time, but I was in touch. And most of them, the moms are still living, and we are in touch. Anytime that it's something needed, they've always been able to get in touch with me, the moms, that is. And they've lived their lives, and I've lived mine. It wasn't that... usually something happened, but it was never something so bad until it was what we call knockdown, drag out. We've mm-hmm. always stayed in touch. And all the moms are living except three.
One of your recordings that I particularly love happens to be a recording with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Your recording of Don't Get Around Much Anymore.
Right.
I mean, gee, you don't even play guitar on this. It's so strange. It's such a unusual recording. My fantasy is that someday you'll record an album of jazz standards.
You must be reading my mind.
Really? Well, go ahead and do it.
Yes, I'm hoping to do that someday with standard tunes like Don't Get Around Much Anymore and tunes of that kind. You know what else? I would also want to do an instrumental album doing tunes like the Beatles did and other known tunes like that
uh-huh.
of today. I would like to do both.
I had a feel to sing with the Ellington Orchestra.
Frightening.
And not have a guitar. I mean, I don't think
well,
you're playing.
Well, I was afraid to try to sing, and trying to play guitar would have been just too much. But today I'm more familiar with a lot of the standard tunes, and I would like to try and play the melodies instead of singing them.
B.B. King, it's really been such a delight to talk with you. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you. You're very kind to talk with. I enjoy your voice.
B.B. King's new autobiography is called Blues All Around Me.